For those of you who don't know, I am Edwin DePonte. I'm Vice President of Academic Affairs and Dean of the Seminary. And it's my honor and pleasure to welcome you to this event here at Lancaster Theological Seminary, where we strive to provide theological education for every generation while trying to live out the biblical admonition to not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And one way we do that here at Lancaster Seminary is through the celebration of LGBT Week. It was in 2000 that a group of students, three students, approached the administration, hint to current students, to see that if it was possible to have a week to raise awareness and celebrate GLBT diversity within the Seminary. And now all these years later, we've had weeks every year since. And this week, we've been focusing on issues of family and politics, culture, human nature, theology, and congregational life. And as the capstone of this week, celebration of LGBT Week, we have the LGBT Week lecture. So without further ado, I'm going to invite my colleague, Dr. Derek Hicks, to come forward and introduce our speaker. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And it's okay to be to clap and be expressive. I'm from the Baptist Church. Well, we are honored to have Dr. Catherine Tanner here with us this morning. She was trained and began her career at Yale University, now serving as the Dorothy Grant McClear Professor of Theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School. She does constructive Christian theology in the Protestant tradition with an intent of addressing contemporary challenges to belief through the creative use of both the history of Christian thought and interdisciplinary methods such as critical, social, and feminist theory. Her books, God and Creation in Christian Theology and Politics of God, discuss the coherence and practical force of Christian beliefs about God's relation to the world. Her book, Theories of Culture, A New Agenda for Theology, explores the relevance of cultural studies for rethinking theological method. Her brief systematic theology, Jesus, Humanity, and the Trinity, centers on the Incarnation. Her latest book is Economy of Grace, exploring the intersections between theology and economics. Regarding the reason she often writes about economics, Dr. Tanner responds that she seeks to look at basic Christian beliefs about the nature of God's dealings with the world as creator and sustainer, and frames those basic claims in an alternative, dare I say, divine economy. She asks, if unmerited grace can be given without condition, what would society and culture be like if the same principle was applied to an unconditional distribution of money? A truly fascinating idea indeed, vis-a-vis the historical reality of American injustice and unmerited privilege. But that's a subject for another stirring lecture. Today, Dr. Tanner engages us with another and equally provocative question. What does being queer have to do with being Christian, she asks. She states that, quote, they have more in common than one might think. Central to both are intimate relations with others that the wider society finds unnatural, and an interest in the way those intimate relations promote new forms of personal transformation and community, end quote. Through this conceptualization of the complexities and messiness of the Christian life, Dr. Tanner comes to us as the right prophetic voice in the right season. And we, the gentle listeners, await her disclosure and charge with bated breath. LTS community and friends, I give you Dr. Catherine Tanner.
I think I'm supposed to be over here because of the mic setup, but just let me say thank you to all of you for coming. You know, it's my great pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to talk to you for some time now, so it's just wonderful to be here. I want to suggest this morning that for all the vituperative opposition that we all know about by the Catholic Church and the conservative wing of almost every Protestant denomination to gay rights and gay life, there nevertheless exists a deep fundamental affinity between being queer and being Christian, an affinity whose grounds in Christianity are quite long-standing and abiding, even traditional, if you will. Queer life and Christian life have more in common than might appear at first blush if you were judging such a question by the contemporary hostilities between the two. At root, they're linked by a set of common projects, which you can find in Christianity as far back as you care to go. Of central concern to both, first of all, are intimate relationships with others that might be considered by the wider society unnatural. They're both working to establish intense forms of interpersonal connection, which seem to violate prevailing sociocultural norms about intimacy, about what, to express this most generally and abstractly perhaps, about what can and cannot appropriately be combined or united with what, intimately bound up together, immediately joined. And secondly, both concern the new possibilities for individual transformation in community life that result from such unnatural intimacies. New ways of becoming a human being and of living together are ultimately at stake. Now, the plausibility of any suggestion like this, any argument like this, depends, of course, on what you think Christianity and queer life are all about. It's only on certain understandings of both Christianity and queer life that they'll seem to have anything this fundamentally to do with one another. If your understanding of Christianity and queer life are substantially different from mine, well, then my case about commonalities might very well seem ridiculous and nonsensical. So that's a lot of what I'm going to try to lay out for you today. The view of queer life, the view of Christianity that would bring to the surface, allow one to emphasize what they have in common: unnatural intimacies and a concern for their social and cultural implications, the new possibilities for human becoming and community living that come with them. The view of queer life I'm going to espouse here is one that's heavily influenced by the person I take to be the greatest theorist of gay life in the 20th century, although he's rarely portrayed that way in academic circles. That's not the usual basis for his scholarly reputation. I'm talking about Michel Foucault. The understanding of Christianity is my own. I'm a systematic theologian. I hope it won't seem too idiosyncratic a theological position, but it's an understanding of Christianity that I've developed in conversation with the broad history of Christian thought in terms of theological trajectories that go back to the early church, that have roots in the early church. Lines of Christian reflection that might be evident, indeed most evident there in the first 5 centuries or so of the Common Era. So first, my understanding of gay life. With Foucault, I don't think the primary project, if you will, of gay existence is finding out who one is, uncovering the truth about oneself, bringing out into the open what had hitherto been the secret of one's existence, what's been pushed into the depths, perhaps even unrecognized by oneself, because of an unwelcoming, forbidding world that simply won't recognize and accept who one is. Although the importance of agitation for full social inclusion and civil rights can't be denied or overlooked, the ultimate point of queer activism for Foucault is accordingly not to bring to light a hitherto squashed sexual identity, or many of them, for public recognition and acceptance, to gain for minority sexual identities or preferences a public place alongside the panoply of multicultural others now due respect and full rights of citizenship. The point of gay activism isn't to fit into the ranks of those with an accepted claim to public attention and social support by way of some sort of supplementation to the existing social classification system. The ultimate aim is not to have sexual minorities added to the list of racial or ethnic minorities whose civil rights are long overdue, to gain civil rights by claiming a status for sexual identity, something like a racial or ethnic identity. To return to the more personal side of things, to return to the question of one's relations with oneself, as Foucault would say, uncovering one's sexual identity or one's true sexual preferences shouldn't be viewed as the key to the intelligibility of one's existence, what supplies the underlying principle of intelligibility that gives meaning to one's life. Oh, this is who I am, this is what my struggles have been all about, this is the source of my frustration and unhappiness in a world that assumes heterosexuality. This is the root of any possible fulfillment or satisfaction that I can look forward to. Nor should one's sexual identity be taken to be the underlying cause of all that one's to become. The reason for what one goes on to do, the determining factor establishing one's future place in the world, one's responsibilities to others and ongoing political commitments. Everything doesn't unfold or unroll from it, or from anything else for that matter. One shouldn't think, I am gay and therefore I will or must be on that basis X, Y, or Z. Contrary to what a preoccupation with sexual identity suggests, resistance to an uncomprehending and uncaring world doesn't fundamentally mean gaining the ability to act on what one has discovered about who one is, finding the space to express one's identity freely, to manifest desires that an oppressive world has kept in check, under wraps, enchained to social expectations about heterosexual behavior. The primary aim of social movements by gay people and their allies should not be to liberate repressed and suppressed desires, to free people from external coercion, from laws and norms imposed upon them that make them do what they don't want to do. Although, of course, liberation efforts have their importance, no one is in favor of coercion or repression. Finally, the Gay Project, for all the above reasons, shouldn't be thought of as one of becoming transparent to oneself by having an outside that matches one's inside once one can act on one's desires, once one is no longer forced to hide or deny what one feels, either publicly or to oneself. The fundamental aim is not to overcome self-division and a life otherwise opaque or incomprehensible to oneself by being who one is, by leading a life true to oneself, a for once coherent, self-consistent life. At the root of these gay preoccupations with identity are, Foucault thinks, the very mechanisms by which modern regimes of power maintain their grips on bodies and pleasures. Rather than contesting such mechanisms, gay preoccupations with sexual identity feed into them and reinforce them. By combining techniques for obsessive attention to bodily states that are found in religious confession, combining these with meticulous scientific forms of classification and evaluation, it's the modern regime of power that gets people to tell the truth about their sexuality, that multiplies discourses about it, that brings sexuality into the open as a focus for special interest and intervention. Quote, this is from Foucault, of course, what is peculiar to modern societies, in fact, is not that they consigned sex to a shadow existence, but that they dedicated themselves to speaking of it ad infinitum, while exploiting it as the secret, unquote. Since the 18th century, Foucault says, discourses on sex did not multiply apart from or against power, but in the very space and as the means of its exercise. Incitements to speech were orchestrated from all quarters, procedures for observing, questioning, and formulating. This is a singular imperialism, he says, that compels everyone to transform their sexuality into a perpetual discourse so that we convince ourselves that we've never said enough on the subject. That through inertia or submissiveness, we conceal from ourselves the blinding evidence, and that what's essential always eludes us, so that we must always start out once again in search of it. Quote. What's the rationale for this level of interest? Sexual behaviors and proclivities were deemed, again, this is from Foucault, were deemed capable of entailing the most varied consequences throughout one's existence. Sex as the cause of anything and everything was, Foucault maintains, the theoretical underside of a confession about it that had to be thorough, meticulous, and constant, and at the same time operate within a scientific type of practice. In the modern field of relations of force or power, the deployment of sex through one's sexuality becomes the point, moreover, through which, again I'm quoting Foucault, each individual has to pass in order to have access to his or her own intelligibility, seeing that it's both the hidden aspect and the generative principle of meaning to the whole of one's body, since it's a real and threatened part of it, which symbolically constitutes the whole, to one's identity, since it joins the force of a biological drive to the singularity of a personal history, unquote. In this modern regime of power, sex and sexuality are not so much refused as used, intensified, multiplied, and diffused. We're dealing, Foucault says, not nearly so much with a negative mechanism of exclusion. That issue is not a movement bent on pushing rude sex back into some obscure and inaccessible region, back into the closet, but on the contrary, a process that spreads it over the surface of things and bodies, arouses it, draws it out, and bids it speak, implants it in reality, and enjoins it to tell the truth. An entire glittering sexual array reflected in a myriad of discourses and in the interplay of knowledge tailored to the requirements of power, unquote. Here, power works not so much through repression as through incitement, not by forcing you to do what you don't want to do, by forcing you to live a lie, but by getting you to want what you want, by generating, heightening, and magnifying the significance of the very desires you come to have. Consequently, for Foucault, sexuality must not be thought of as a kind of natural given, which power tries to hold in check, or a furtive reality that's difficult to grasp, but a great surface network, he says, in which the stimulation of bodies, the intensification of pleasures, the incitement to discourse and so on have been linked in certain strategies of knowledge and power. Sexuality is tied to recent devices of power, linked from the onset with an intensification of the body, its exploitation as an object of knowledge and an element in relations of power, unquote. Sex becomes such a crucial political issue in contemporary times because it forms the pivot between two fundamental axes that govern human behavior. One having to do with the discipline of the body in schools, prisons, hospitals, the workplace, and the second with the regulation of whole populations through state policies. Quote, sex was a means of access both to the life of the body and the life of the species. It was employed as a standard for bodily discipline and as a basis for regulation. This is why sexuality was sought out and tracked down. Why it became the stamp of individuality. It's what enabled one to analyze one's body and master its capabilities and movements. But this is also why it became the theme of political operations, economic interventions, and ideological campaigns. It could be put forward as the index of a society's, a whole society's strength, revealing both its political energy and biological vigor, unquote. In this climate, lifting up for recognition desires and practices that society might otherwise consider sexually perverse does no good. No antidote to the usual workings of power lies that way, as if the problem to begin with were simply overly restrictive sexual norms enforcing, say, the exclusive privilege of sex within heterosexual marriage for reproductive purposes. The type of power we're familiar with today has, quote, neither the form of law nor the effects of taboo. On the contrary, it acts by multiplication of singular sexualities. It doesn't set boundaries for sexuality. It extends the various forms of sexuality. Modern society itself is therefore already in actual fact and directly perverse. Manifold sexualities find their correlates here in exact procedures of power. These polymorphous sexual conducts are actually drawn out, revealed, isolated, intensified, incorporated by equally multifarious power devices. He has in mind here in particular what happens in schools, in prisons, mental hospitals. It's through the isolation, intensification, and consolidation of peripheral sexualities that the relations of power to sex and pleasure branched out and multiplied, measured the body, and penetrated modes of conduct, unquote. So what's the alternative if there are clear limits to the sociocultural subversion that can come by way of uncovering sexual identity? If one doesn't want to make the assumption of an identity a necessity in gay life, something all important, for example, because it determines what one is, what one must do, what one must always be close to, which side one must be on, the meaning of one's life. If one finds, as I think Foucault did, a preoccupation with identity, am I this, am I that, or neither, or both, or more, or too complex to be classified, as just too self-limiting in the possibilities it opens for gay life. Well, the alternative is to see who one is as a gay person, one's identity, as developing over the course of one's life in and through the intimate relationships one forms with others, and to make the character of those relationships with others, indeed their broader sociocultural implications, the primary matter of importance about gay life. Being gay is about the self-transformation, the work on oneself that happens through new forms of intimate relationship with others, forms of intimate relationship that make possible not just new sexually charged experiences, but new modes or ways of living together with a significant import for the wider society. As Foucault says, quote, we don't have to discover that we're homosexuals or what the meaning of this is. Rather, we have to create a gay life to become, unquote. The project, one could say, of gay life is not to be gay, but to become gay, where becoming gay is something that happens by way of the new social and cultural possibilities that sexual relationships in violation of, or just at some odd angle to heterosexual norms, open up. Can being gay be all about developing richer, more interesting, and creative forms of cultural and social life to counteract an otherwise often sterile, sanitized, rigidly organized, and impoverished social fabric? Might being gay have to do with becoming gay, where becoming gay is all about the sort of intense relations one establishes with others, relations different from any institutionalized in society in their novelty, potential richness, and experimental character? Foucault recommends, in his own words, that we, quote, distrust the tendency to relate the question of homosexuality to the problem of who I am and what's the secret of my desire. Perhaps it would be better to ask oneself what relationships through homosexuality can be established, invented, multiplied, and modulated. The problem is not to discover in oneself the truth of one's sex, he goes on, but rather to use one's sexuality henceforth to arrive at a multiplicity of relationships. And no doubt that's the real reason homosexuality is not a form of desire, but something desirable. Therefore, we have to work at becoming homosexuals and not be obstinate in recognizing that we are. We work on ourselves and invent. I, Foucault, he's speaking here, do not say discover, a manner of being or way of life that's still improbable and unforeseen. To paraphrase his conclusions, what the wider society fears are not just sexual acts that contravene the natural order or natural law, but what there is in them of affection, tenderness, friendship, fidelity, camaraderie, and companionship that might spell the possible formation of new alliances and the tying together of unforeseen lines of force. Wider sociocultural transformations, in short, that aren't based on the usual social divisions, but are more polymorphic, he says, varied and individually modulated. The common fear, according to Foucault, is that gays will develop relationships that are intense and satisfying, even though they don't conform at all to the ideas of relationships held by others. It's the prospect that gays, apart from socially established codes and guidelines, will create as yet unforeseen kinds of relationships that people can't tolerate, unquote. Now let's turn to Christianity. It seems to me that there's a fundamental affinity between the way gay life has just been described and what Christianity understands to be the proper project of human life generally. Christianity thinks of human life in general as an experiment in personal transformation and community formation, because human beings generally, as a species, have no determinate, no clearly bounded and specifiable identity sufficient in and of itself to establish the proper directions that human life should take. This is my view of Christianity as a systematic theologian. Human life is an experiment, a genuinely open project, because what humans as individuals and in community are to become depends not on their identity, something that could conceivably be determined in advance, but on ongoing relations of intimacy, specifically with God, intimate relations that are unpredictable simply from our side and that come to us in the form of unforeseen gifts. Becoming what we are in virtue of intimate relations with God, our lives are no more transparent to us than God's own life is transparent to us. Our lives will never make sense to us if we simply search for a correspondence between our actions in the world and our fundamental desires, between what we do and who we are. Our underlying identity or nature as human beings can never be a sufficient principle of intelligibility, revealing the meaning of our lives, if in between who we are and what we eventually become lies God, the character of our relationship with a God beyond our grasp. For all these reasons, I'll suggest human life generally, from a Christian point of view, is unnatural in senses I'll specify, but certainly as unnatural as anything that gay people could be charged with. Human beings are unnatural beings, and their relations with God are unnatural relations of intimacy. Indeed, if Jesus Christ is the paradigm of those relations of intimacy with God, if relations of intimacy with God are found in him at the extreme, if in him one finds the most intimate relationship with God that's conceivable, then Jesus is the most unnatural of humans, and the community we form with each other in virtue of our community with him is the most unnatural of communities. Now, I won't be able to develop these ideas in the short time I have, but let me take some of them in turn to give you a better sense of what I'm talking about here. Let's start with, and I think I'll probably end with, the first one about human identity, since it's in some ways the crucial one for comparative purposes here, if we're to see the affinity with Foucault's understanding of gay life. A lot of Christian theological interest in human beings might seem to be primarily about the effort to delimit, to define the specific character of human nature, what human beings are basically like, all those fundamental capacities and inclinations that clearly set them off from other creatures not similarly disposed. For example, theological interest in what makes human beings the image of God seems to take this tack. You're interested in their exact nature. That makes humans the image of God. The idea behind this sort of theological interest would seem to be that, like other creatures, human beings have been created by God with a certain identity. They have a particular God-given nature. And it's important to be clear what that is, since God's intention in creating you that way is for you to live according to your nature. Creatures are meant to live out in an excellent fashion what God makes them capable of. If they're acting properly, as God wants them to, their lives would simply unroll from their created natures, developing or actualizing the potentials specific to them as the particular type of creature they are. You've been created as a pig or a tree or a human being, and what God wants you to be is the best pig or tree or human being you can be. Perfect yourself in keeping with the specific sort of thing you've been created to be. Created identity in this way becomes the generative principle or root cause of all one is to become. Who or what one is determines what one can be. Nothing very mysterious here. Figure out what your identity or nature is, and you have the key to what your life is supposed to be like, what everything you go on to do is supposed to conform with or abide by. But I think one can interpret much of what Christian theologians say about human nature another way, as suggesting that human beings stand out from other creatures by not having any specific created nature to be true to. They're not created by God to be a particular type of creature and to live out that nature, to live according to this specific identity that makes them what they are. Instead, they're created to have a specific identity that their relationship with God establishes. The only nature they're to have is the one they gain by way of that relationship. They haven't any particular created nature apart from the relationship with God that makes them what they properly are. That relationship with God determines their identity. Apart from it, they haven't any. Human beings, therefore, either don't have a specific identity or nature at all, considered in and of themselves in the way a pig or a tree has one, or that just is their specific identity or nature, not to be anything in particular, apart from the relationship with God that makes them what they are. In this sense, human nature is unnatural if the standard is set by other created things. The metaphors that the theologians I'm most influenced by employ when talking about human nature clarify what I'm getting at here. Following Gregory of Nyssa or Basil the Great or Irenaeus, these early church figures, one could say human beings are like mirrors or empty vessels or soft wax or writing tablets. They gain their character, the only definite character they have, from what they're impressed or filled up by, from what they mirror or reflect. And what God intends them to be filled or impressed by, or to reflect, is God. Humans, in short, are not designed by God to be anything on their own. Human capacities are designed to be indefinite and unformed, apart from the relationship with God that's supposed to give shape to them. The relationship with God at issue is one of peculiar intimacy. God is indeed closer to us than we are to ourselves, in that God becomes in this way an ingredient, a kind of ingredient in our very constitution as the sort of creatures we are. God must be present within us for us to assume our properly created character, what we're meant by God to be. If God is not within us as the fundamental principle directing our formation, we simply cannot be ourselves and function as we should. The operations of our native capacities are not self-sufficient ones, simply unrolling from those native capacities, but require the presence of God shaping and forming them in order to operate properly in excellent fashion. To give you some common examples from the history of Christian thought of the way God's formative presence is necessary for the excellent operation of human capacities, consider what Augustine and Thomas Aquinas affirm about human beings. They say that human beings know or choose well only when such judgments are made against the background of a standard of divine truth and divine goodness that at least implicitly informs at the most fundamental level what the human mind and will seek. We recognize on some level that what we affirm is not the absolute truth, and that what we want is not the absolute good, that neither approach God's own truth and goodness. And therefore we gain the proper perspective on what we know and desire, seeing them for what they are, say in the case of what we will or want, that these things are good in only certain respects for certain purposes, but not investing ourselves too much in them or expecting from them what they can't deliver. We remain free from the objects of our desire. They don't absolutely or unconditionally determine our will, force us to want them as a result, following Thomas Aquinas very closely. The kind of intimacy with God, the intimacy that comes from the fact that the presence of God is an ingredient of our natures, is often given a Trinitarian spin and read right into the creation narratives by the theologians I'm most influenced by. While there are lots of hints of it before him, one can see the full-blown development of such a view of creation, for example, in the theology of Cyril of Alexandria in the early church. We're created by God to be shaped into the form or the pattern of the second person of the Trinity by the presence of the Spirit given to us, the Holy Spirit given to us at our creation. By the power of the Spirit, that character of the second person of the Trinity was to be impressed upon human lives that were made open and malleable to it from the very beginning. That's what it means to be created in the image of God. To be so shaped is not the destiny, not just the destiny we're created with, as somebody like Irenaeus in the early church would affirm, but it was our original created state. We're not made to live well in any other way. To be formed into the image of the second person of the Trinity by the power of the Spirit is our very created nature in the sense that it's the only sort of life that God intended us to lead. The relationship with God that God created us to have is also an intimate one, characterized by a heightened degree of personal intimacy. Because our lives are properly shaped by God's presence within us only when we relate to God in love. When our whole character becomes God-directed and concerned, when God is made the intense focus of our will, our affections, and desires. We're formed by God in the way God intends us to be. We're attached to God, not just through forms of physical closeness that are a function of God's drawing near to us, becoming present to us, even uniting with us in Christ, but when we're attached to God through forms of our own concentrated attention, in which we turn ourselves to God with all that we are in faith, hope, and love. We can have God for our own. God may be present to and within us, offering us the powers of God's own way of living as powers upon which we can draw to lead new lives. But if we were blind to that fact, ignore it, make nothing of it, it's as good as nothing to us. Our lives fall into self-destructive patterns that are sinful. The fact that we lost this Godward orientation or never properly displayed it is part of what God's coming into the world in Christ is to remedy. In Christ, God joins us to, knits us into God in a way that our wayward dispositions can't obstruct. Christ provides an unshakable basis for new forms of intimacy with God, for newly transformed hearts and minds. Now, lots of creatures, most, maybe all of them, in fact, are not made by God to lead self-sufficient lives either. Living things exhibit complex relations of dependence on their environments and on other organisms. Living things don't grow, for example, into what their natures allow them to become without taking things that are not themselves inside themselves. Plants don't grow without assimilating within themselves, making part of themselves, water, sunlight, nutrients from the soil, and so on. So here there might be a parallel with the case of human beings. Nothing very unusual or unnatural here. Lots of things depend on intimate relations with what they're not to be what they are. Relations of intimacy in the sense that the very presence of foreign materials within them is a necessity for them to become themselves. The only thing that would make human beings exceptional, though this is a pretty big exception, is that God is the necessary ingredient in the human case. Unlike other things, humans require God for their nourishment in order to grow and to be fulfilled, to be perfected, to realize what they're capable of. But more than this, what makes our intimate relations of dependence upon God unnatural is that through them, God is not being assimilated to us, but we're being assimilated to God. In the case of other living things that take foreign materials within themselves for their sustenance, the foreign materials are made useful to them by being broken down and refashioned, respun into their own natures. The air, water, nutrients, which a plant makes use of, become plant-like, if you will, in keeping with the fact that the point of the whole process is for the plant itself to be augmented, to be more itself, to grow into itself. When God becomes an ingredient in human life, to the contrary, God remains foreign to us, what we're not, unchanged, I would argue, in the process. God remains just as God has always been, and we are the ones to be changed into something like God by having God as the principle of our own formation, what gives us shape. The point of the process is not for us to become ourselves or more ourselves, to become what we already are or otherwise could be. The point of the process is for us to become something else, something like God, for us to be assimilated within the divine life and to show off its character in a created form. So here's the Christian interest in radical human transformability, in human life as an open experiment, a Christian interest to match Foucault's. Natural malleability is what's of theological interest about human nature. In contrast to other creatures whose nature seem to set some definite term or limit or goal of their aspirations, human life takes quite variable forms across different cultures and social groups, as we contemporary people know so well, but also along a moral axis from the most depraved to the most virtuous, something that theologians have always been concerned about. No other animal can be this bad or potentially this good. Human beings are capable, for better or worse, of making objects of themselves in projects of self-fashioning that depend in great part upon their own free decisions about what it is that's most important to them. This unusually malleable character of human nature, which is often traced back by theologians to the fact that we have rational volition, to the fact that we freely decide what to make of our lives according to a rational apprehension or judgment about what it is that's most valuable to us, this unusual malleability is what opens human life ultimately to the most radical of transformation. Our human lives, individually and together, are to take on the very character of the divine life. Rather than limiting us to ways of existing that are continuous with the creaturely, our created nature instead opens us to what creatures are not, to what no creature can be in and of itself, to God, to leading a way of life that exceeds the capacities of any creature because enabled by God's presence within us. A divine way of life is what our human lives are always properly on the way to, what human existence is always trying to approximate when human life is on the right track. Living a divine way of life is, in other words, the ultimate end or purpose of human existence, one that's peculiarly in keeping with the unnatural nature of human beings. Our natural end, in the sense of the end that God created us from the beginning to achieve, is an unnatural one, in that we're to be pushed through divine power, through some divine transformative influence, to become what we're not and have no capacity of being by ourselves, divinely shaped humans. We're to be completed as human beings, fulfilled, when we come to behave unnaturally in a God-informed rather than simply human way. We're ultimately to be transformed into something beyond anything we can imagine, because we're to be transformed into something like God. And therefore, the fundamental human project cannot be to become transparent to ourselves by living in accord with our God-given nature. What we're to become remains a mystery to us, hidden in the God who escapes our comprehension. What we will be is not yet revealed, as one finds in 1 John 3:2-3. We remain a mystery to ourselves because who we are to become remains bound up with the mystery of God's own life. Thank you.